Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
On behalf of the University of California, Irvine and the School of Social Sciences, I'm pleased to welcome you all to the 17th annual Margolis Lecture. The Margolis Lecture recognizes Dr. Margolis, a founding faculty member of the Center for Global Peace and Conflict Studies and of the Department of Economics. Tonight, we're very honored to host Dr. Vandana Shiva. Dr. Shiva is a physicist, ecologist, activist, editor, and the author of many books. She received the PhD on topics in quantum theory from the University of Western Ontario and then shifted to interdisciplinary research in science, technology, and environmental policy at the Indian Institute of Science and the Indian Institute of Management in Bangalore. In India, she has established Navdhyana, a national movement for biodiversity conservation and farmers' rights, and she is the founding director of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Ecology, a network of researchers specializing in ecology, health, and sustainability in New Delhi. She has established a school for sustainability, Bija Vidyapith, she'll probably pronounce it correctly later, on the Navdhyana Biodiversity Farm. Her most recent books are Earth Democracy and Water Wars, and her other books include Monocultures of the Mind, The Violence of the Green Revolution, and Stolen Harvest. Dr. Shiva has served as an ecology advisor to the Third World Network, which aims to bring about a fair and ecologically sustainable distribution of resources. And she's also on the board of the International Forum on Globalization and World Future Council. Please join me in greeting Dr. Shiva, who will speak tonight on the new food wars, globalizations, GMOs, and biofuels. Welcome.
I'd like to thank the Center for Peace and Conflict Studies. So I'm happy to be here with you. And when I talk about food wars, I'm not only talking about the 40 countries where there have been riots, because I believe food wars are taking place everywhere, even where there are no riots. And food wars have now become so pervasive that we kind of have created an immunity to see the conflicts at a daily level that are triggered by the way food is produced, processed, and distributed. My lessons in food as a zone of war and agriculture as war really started with 1984. It was really an Orwellian year for us in India. Remember George Orwell, 1984? In June that year, the most sacred shrine of the Sikhs had been invaded by the Indian military. Indira Gandhi had announced that she would take it on, because in Amritsar, in the Gurdwara there, in the Golden Temple, Bhindarwale, a Sikh extremist, was hiding. Punjab had become a land of war in that period. I don't know how many of you remember Kanishka, the airplane that was blown up, flying from Canada to Cork, blew up over Ireland. In December that year, a tragedy took place in the city of Bhopal, where a gas leaked from a pesticide plant. 3,000 people were killed in that one night. 30,000 have been killed since then. In Punjab, in the violence of Punjab, in those years of the late 70s and early 80s, 30,000 people were killed. So if you add just Bhopal and Punjab together, you have 12 times 9/11. And all of this related very directly to agriculture as war. Interestingly, Punjab is the zone where the Green Revolution was first applied. The package called the Green Revolution was first applied. And the Green Revolution is called the Green Revolution because the architects had thought they were creating an alternative to the Red Revolution, but they did leave a very bloody revolution in Punjab. The Green Revolution was based on chemicals, new seeds designed for chemicals. Very, very centralized management for agriculture, and of course very centralized water management to feed the water for intensive irrigation for chemical farming. The Green Revolution was awarded a Nobel Prize for Peace in, I think it was 1970. Norman Borlaug got it. And Borlaug was given the prize because the idea was, with these new seeds, they were called miracle seeds, and the 12 people that Borlaug sent out to spread these seeds in the world, he called them his apostles. And I always say, this was supposed to be in science. When did it become religion? But it has functioned as religion. These new seeds were supposed to bring prosperity. Prosperity was supposed to bring peace. But peace wasn't the reality of Punjab. And I had been working for the United Nations at that time on conflicts over natural resources in a major program on peace and global transformation. And I had a file of clippings on conflicts over rivers, conflicts over water, conflicts over development questions, natural resource questions. And after 4th of June, all of that disappeared, and it was as if it was a religious conflict. But I knew it wasn't a religious conflict, so I just decided to study it more deeply. And at the end of it, wrote my book called The Violence of the Green Revolution. And it's also around that time I wrote Monocultures of the Mind. Because what I realized watching Punjab, studying Punjab, was actually per acre nutrition output had not increased in Punjab. Punjab had stopped cultivating pulses, and we in India need our dals. Punjab had stopped cultivating oil seeds. It's regional dish is makki ki roti and sarson ka saag, corn bread eaten with mustard greens. You don't find corn in Punjab anymore. It was wiped out. Punjab became a land of Green Revolution wheat in the Rabi season, this winter crop, and then Green Revolution rice in the next season. One monoculture replaced by another monoculture. You see nothing else. The tractorization made sure every tree was cut, every commons was enclosed. And of course, this was a ready-made recipe for breeding pests, non-sustainability. When I did my study in the 80s, 10% of Punjab land was a waterlogged or salt saline desert because of intensive irrigation, and 50% of the soils were diseased and dying. Because you can't do an agriculture where you just keep taking out and taking out and taking out nutrients. And plants need more than nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium. They need, like we need trace elements and micronutrients, the soil needs micronutrients, and the plants need micronutrients and trace elements. And they don't come from NPK, they don't come from the urea that came out of the explosives industry. In fact, that's the real food war, I really believe. That the tools for industrial agriculture are tools of warfare. When the wars ended, they were deployed in agriculture. The pesticides were meant to kill, the herbicides were meant to kill, they were just moved, which is why Bhopal killed. Of course, the Green Revolution is being now replaced by what's called the Second Green Revolution. And I find it very interesting that everyone, including our Prime Minister, he repeatedly talks about the Green Revolution has failed. We now need the Second Green Revolution. Now, one would imagine there'd be basic intelligence to say, the Green Revolution failed. Let's see why it failed. Let's not do it again. And instead, there seems to be a human habit to say, if we failed once, just do it more, bigger, faster. And somehow, it'll get a different result. Genetic engineering is the so-called Second Green Revolution. And many of you who are students won't remember this. Hopefully some of you who are older might. 1972, in a conference center in Asilomar, the early founders of genetic engineering got together. The people who had worked on how to splice the genes and create recombinant genetic material. They got together and said, we are playing with life. We don't know the consequences. We are going to put a moratorium on our research till we understand this better. That was 1972. Very rapidly, industry started to buy up patents. Molecular biology moved out of universities and public systems into Wall Street. And genetic engineering became a new miracle, except that the difference was the first green revolution was deployed through public systems, you know, through national agriculture research systems, through the International Agriculture Research Institutes called the CGIAR system, the Consultative Group on International Agriculture Research. The second green revolution is totally deployed by gene giants who used to be chemical giants, who used to, till the 70s, the only reputation of some of these companies was making chemicals for warfare. And today they are our seed sellers. They are determining the beginning of our food chain. Partly because they rushed so fast, they've generated another war around our food system, which is a war around knowledge and war around science. At this point, there's a huge split between molecular biologists who understand the complexity and uncertainty of life at the genetic structure and the genetic engineering industry or biotech industry or the life sciences industry, which is basically saying we know exactly what we are doing and how we manipulate. But if they were that smart, they would be doing what they said. You know, 20 years ago, I was having debates with them, and they'd say, these technologies will allow us to grow corn in the Sahara and wheat on the moon. After 20 years, all we have is two traits. Herbicide-resistant crops, so the companies that sell herbicides can now sell us more herbicides. And Bt toxin crops. Of course, they don't call them Bt toxin crops. They say pest resistance, herbicide tolerance. The Bt toxin crops is the one that has really unleashed tremendous wars. Early research started to show us that when you start to put a toxin into the plant, and now the plant is making its own toxin, you're going to have serious results. The Cornell study showed how Bt pollen killed the monarch butterfly. Other research showed how soil microorganisms are impacted. Now, Bt cotton is a cotton with this Bt gene in it, and its trade name is Bolgard when Monsanto sells it. In 1998, I remember it was, around August, Monsanto put a huge ad in the papers in India saying, by next year, Indian farmers will have this tremendously new miracle seed called Bolgard, which will not be attacked by pests. But I'd been working on this stuff from 1984, so I knew Monsanto, I knew more Bolgard, and I said, it's interesting. They're saying by next year they'll sell it. I rang up the Ministry of Environment. Did they get approvals through you? No, we don't know anything about it. We happen to have a law more advanced than this country does. This country has no law to regulate genetic engineering. We have an Environment Protection Act with a law for the control of genetically engineered organisms and their release into the environment. It was written by the scientists who knew what they were doing. And Monsanto, of course, thought it had walked through the US administration. It was going to walk through the Indian system. They didn't need to seek approval. So I sued them in the courts. And they could not introduce it the next year. They couldn't introduce it till 2002. By 2002, something changed. The very same government which used to work with me to regulate the biotech industry, to negotiate in the international treaties for the biosafety protocol. This is the protocol for biosafety regulation under the Convention on Biological Diversity, which is one of the agreements that came out of the Earth Summit in 1992. I'm starting to feel terribly old talking about all these dates. That's how old I am. The same government was now, in March of 2002, they had found some BT crops and had ordered uprooting and said, this is dangerous. We don't know what it does to the soil. We can't have it growing with all over the place. And they had it uprooted. And within a month, Monsanto had done something. I know in Indonesia they were caught bribing officials $175,000 for getting approvals. But they did something in between, and they managed to get the approval. So here was the same government I used to work with on regulation. I'm now having to sue them because they've given this approval without any testing. These issues, these food wars continue. And in this food war around genetic engineering, issues have gone all the way to the World Trade Organization. Partly because in the U.S., they achieved a total deregulation. I don't know how many of you, again, remember someone called Dan Quayle. You're so obsessed with Hillary versus Obama these days. And there used to be a guy called Dan Quayle who couldn't spell potato. But they put him in charge of your food system. And he came back, you know, because we managed to achieve this biosafety protocol articles in the Convention on Biological Diversity, Senior President Bush and Quayle came back and said, we're not going to allow this regulation. So they put into U.S. law a principle called substantial equivalence. Just pretend genetically engineered foods and crops are like non-genetically engineered ones. Pretend, don't look, don't see, you'll never find. And that's how you've got unlabeled food. States like Vermont tried to label milk that was produced through injecting genetically engineered bovine growth hormone, the first GM product. The federal government sued the states, said you can't label. And by deliberate policy, the US public has been kept in the dark. In India, what this has basically ended up doing is taking the lives of our farmers. I knew the monopolies would be harmful at the socioeconomic level. I knew the monocultures the GM crops would create would not be very good for sustainability. But I could not have imagined in 1987 that our farmers would start taking their lives because they'd got trapped into these GM seeds. And the GM seeds, people don't, you know, they always say, but why do the farmers choose it? They don't choose it. A video comes into the village, either with a religious epic, Hanumanji of the Ramayana bringing GM crops to deliver the farmer. And according to different regions, they pick the gods of that region. And, you know, we've got 330 million of them to choose from. Indians have all kinds of deities. In Punjab, they use Guru Nanak, who's the sixth saint. So they use all this imagery. And an innocent farmer who's always believed in the Ramayana and believed in Guru Nanak Shabds, he's not going to say, I will test the seed. He just buys it. And he doesn't even buy it. He gets it on credit because he doesn't have the money. The seed costs 3,600 rupees a kilogram. Compared to the zero cost if he used his own seed, and 200 rupees per kilogram if he bought it, an alternative. But the alternatives are destroyed. Before you know it, in the market, there's only BT cotton. There's nothing else available. And before you know it, in the farmers' fields, there's nothing else. The companies engage in what they call seed replacement. They encourage farmers to give up their old seed, give them money. Why do you have to keep this old seed? Here's this new improved variety. And I have debates with my government all the time about this. I said, you know, seeds are not like dirty clothes that need replacement. Seeds are the very embodiment of evolution. They need protection, they need conservation, and they need the continuation of selection and improvement, but they definitely don't have to be thrown away. So what we have in parts of India now is a seed famine, a land rich in biodiversity, the land that gave rise to 1,500 cotton varieties, 200,000 rice varieties, 1,500 mango varieties. Today, in the area where cotton was domesticated, there's no cotton supply except Monsanto's, sold through 17 companies who are licensed, who have licenses with them. The farmers can't afford to keep farming. The credit that they have taken to buy the seed and the chemicals, they can't pay back. because there's another element of the food war, which is linked to international trade. And that is related to the fact that in the early 90s, agribusiness, especially in this country, used huge amounts of subsidies to artificially lower prices. In the US, the cotton subsidy is $4 billion and it goes to a handful of agribusiness farms. But it then allows these companies to sell the cotton at international markets at half the price of the cost of production. And when it's dumped on countries like India or countries in Africa, and it's dumped because the WTO has been another instrument of war, forcing us to remove import restrictions. When these cheap products come in, they undercut our production. The farmer is spending 10 times more for the costs of inputs and earning one third of what they did. And they're squeezed in this negative economy, and squeezed in the negative economy with an unpayable debt. They end up drinking, usually 90% of the farmer's suicides are drinking pesticide on the day the creditors come to grab the land. And this has happened in this country. It's just that the scale and the speed is different in India. 200,000 farmers have taken their lives because it's all got squeezed into a decade. It's happened over a century of destruction of the small family farm in this country. There's a book that to me is very similar to my book on the violence of the Green Revolution. It's called Harvest of Rage. And Harvest of Rage is about the Oklahoma bombings. And it's about the anger among the farmers. But it talks also about the fact that farmers are committing suicide. It's just that it's kind of become normalized. We didn't allow it to get normalized. It took 5 years for me to keep saying farmers are committing suicides because of the economic policies, it's because of globalization, it's because of GM seeds. The first 5 years, the government would keep saying, oh, they must have been alcoholics. They must have been adulterers. And beyond a point, that sounded like a very weak excuse. Now the government gives out the numbers. And last year, you might have heard the government in March, they announced a huge bail, which won't work because it's about public debt. But these farmers are not indebted to public banks. They're indebted to the sales agents of the companies. And that debt will never be forgiven by the government because the government doesn't regulate it or control it. Today, the situation is different. And the situation is different only in one way, that while in the early 90s, for agribusiness to get access to international markets, especially low-cost food markets in third world economies, they had to lower the price below our economic price. We live in a rupee economy. Someone else lives another economy. People are poor. Food has to be affordable. The price stayed at a certain level. And of course, there were other policies, which I'm so proud in India, that were institutionalized after independence, a public distribution system, a universal access to food, remunerative prices for farmers. All of that was one piece by piece broken down either by World Bank structural adjustment or by the World Trade Organization rules. The WTO, the first two cases in WTO were against India. One against the fact that we did not have monopolies in seed and medicine, and we should. And the other that we had import restrictions and we should remove them. This second case was a famous case called quantitative restrictions. Before that, governments were allowed to ban imports of artificially cheap products to protect the domestic producers. Well, now that many, many, many places, the agribusiness has made entry, Cargill, ConAgra. Maybe I should just mention as an aside, most people don't realize how much influence these companies had in the trade rules that became the World Trade Organization agreements. The patent laws are called trade-related intellectual property rights in the WTO. And the TR comes from the fact that actually intellectual property rights has nothing to do with trade. So they just put TR before IP and said it's trade-related by definition now. You just got to have it. And this is where the compulsory patenting of seed, patent monopolies on medicine started. Monsanto has gone on record to say, in shaping this treaty, we were the patient, the diagnostician, and the physician all in one. We defined the problem, we offered the solution, and we showed the way of implementing it, which is bring it to WTO. In the case of the agriculture agreement, which directly affects agriculture and is at the heart of the current food emergency, and I'll just come to how, a senior representative of Cargill was deputed to be the head of agriculture negotiations of the United States government during the Uruguay round of GATT. He went with a government hat. He went as your representative, got the agreement through, and then came back to Cargill. I have called the agreement on agriculture a Cargill agreement. The interesting thing is it has nothing to do with agriculture. It doesn't have a word on soil. It doesn't mention the farmer once. It doesn't say anything about crops. It doesn't say anything about food. It has three subtexts. One is called market access. How do you grab a market? The second is called domestic support. How do you make sure farmers don't get support? And the third is export competition. How do you create subsidies that will be allowed to survive in a WTO? And so much of the subsidy structure comes as incentives. Having entered third world markets, and I'll give you an example to give you a sense, partly because this is being used a lot in explaining the rise in food prices. I know a lot of the material in this country has said that one reason food prices are increasing is because Indians are buying more soybean because they're eating more meat and it's going as cattle feed. It's false all the way. Oh, there's another little part of the story which says because of the high growth rate, Indians have become very rich and therefore they're eating more and therefore there's pressure on the global economy. The second part is so flawed because since these new globalization policies were implemented, hunger has grown in India. The average consumption in India in 1991, before globalization was institutionalized, was 177 kilograms per capita per year, which translates into an availability of 485 grams per capita per year. A year ago, this had dropped to 152 kilograms per capita per year. Indians are eating less. They're eating less because most of them have become poorer. And yes, there is one family that's become very rich, and if you take the two brothers, Ambani brothers they're called, if you add them together, they're richer than Warren Buffett. You know, they are the richest in the world. But you know, how much can two brothers eat? When you get that kind of money, the best they can do is buy their wives private jet planes, build mansions of 16 floors, of which four will be parking lots and three will be swimming pools. That doesn't put a pressure on the food system. It does other things, put pressure on land, obscene consumerism, etc. But Indians are actually eating less. India, with its 9% growth, has emerged as the epicenter of hunger in 2007-2008. UNICEF gave an alert last year. 47% of Indian babies are severely malnourished. 1 million babies are dying before the age of five because of lack of food. The other million die because of lack of clean water. And this is increasing. So this idea that because 9% growth, Indians are eating more, and that's the pressure, it's totally false. Yes, it's true India is buying more soya. But it is not true that Indians are asking for more soya. We're a land rich in biodiversity. I come from the north. Our favorite cooking medium is mustard oil. In Kerala, the land of Kerala, the land of coconut, the favorite medium is coconut. In the Deccan, you get beautiful sesame, Niger, flaxseed, groundnut. We have no dearth of edible oils in our country. We used to be the biggest producers of edible oils. In 1998, our policies were manipulated. And I won't go into the gory story of how, but our indigenous oils were banned under safety criteria, because most of our oils are made in a little village oil mill, a virgin press oil mill, where you take your oil seed, get back the oil, leave the oil cake for the oil miller who feeds it to his animals who are running this, a totally autonomous economic system that can never get impoverished. 1 million of these little oil mills were shut down overnight. The duties on soya were reduced dramatically and import restrictions on soya removed. Within a decade, 70% of India's edible oil consumption is soya and palm oil. But this hasn't happened in an absolute way. It's happened at the cost of the mustard. It's happened at the cost of the coconut. Coconut prices dropped from 10 rupees a nut to 2 rupees a nut. Mustard prices dropped to one third. I know the Indian oil soya farmers, 12 of them were shot dead during protests because of this dumping. And while this was being dumped, I remember the rate, $150 were the international price of soya, $191 per ton was the subsidy on soya. So if that subsidy hadn't been there, there's no way that farmers of India would have been displaced. So it's not the case that Indians wanted soya. They've been forced to eat soya. I remember a particular night, I got a call from women from the slum. I've created an Indian National Alliance of Women for Food Rights. And we've been working on the right to food for very long. And this group of women from the slums call me and say, you talk about food and our kids aren't going to sleep. They're crying because we don't have mustard to cook. It's been banned in the market. And the soya food, they're not eating the soya. So please bring back our mustard. So I said to them, give me 5 days. You know, give me 5 days to first study what really happened and figure out how to get mustard. Well, I did the studies, found out all this hoo-ha on the safety issues was totally fabricated. But I also then very, very quickly found out where to get our organic mustard, found a little mill where we could make it, and I called our chief minister of Delhi for the first bottle of sarson from Satyagraha. You know, Satyagraha was Gandhi's way of not cooperating with unjust and brutal rule. He called it the force of truth. Satya is truth. Agraha is the struggle of truth. And we decided to not cooperate with the ban on our oils. Today, mustard is in the market. But obviously, those 1 million small millers will not be brought back. It needs new initiatives like ours, like Navdanya, to bring them back. The soya that's coming to India is not going to cattle feed. It's going to edible oil. And yet there's this image created that as if all Indians have suddenly become meat eaters. A good vegetarian is a good vegetarian, rich or poor. Wealth does not convert you into meat. Another nutrition story, I think it's another part of the food wars. There's this crazy idea that of a linear plane. As you get richer, you become more meat eaters. In fact, as you get richer, you start to eat your arugula and rocket salad. And all those lovely cheeses from Italy. Another example, which is a very different example, in the case of soya, it was dumping. In the case of wheat, it's the opposite. We are being forced to import wheat. Forced to import wheat. India grows 74 million tons of wheat. It's more than enough for our need. Our need is 69 million tons. It's not scarcity in India that's leading to these imports. Except now that these monopolies have been established and the global market is integrated, now the prices are allowed to rise. Earlier, the price fixing took the prices downwards. Now the price fixing takes it upwards. So Indian farmers sell wheat at 10,000 rupees a ton. Cargill sells wheat at 16,000 rupees a ton, but we are forced to buy from Cargill. Of course, over time, what happens is the 16,000 rupee a ton enters the Indian markets, takes up the consumer price to 20,000 rupees a ton, and drops the farmer's price even further because the market that the farmer would have had has been usurped by the Cargills. And it's not just happening through imports. All kinds of other policy changes take place. I can't go into the details, but maybe in question time we will. India's marketing used to be for food security. The whole trading system was about not speculating, not hoarding, no trader getting too big. It was all about small farmers and small traders. The corporations, the giant corporations, got themselves the right, through World Bank influence, to create private trading centers, which are not governed by regulation of a minimum price. They're not governed by regulation of a maximum price. They're not governed by what is called the Essential Commodities Act, which works on seeing that you're not hoarding. And this, too, has played a role in increasing speculation. If you were to ask me what are the key factors in the current price rise and what is called the silent tsunami, the first is globalization itself. The fact that food that used to be in the hands of 3 billion farmers and millions of traders is now in the hands of 5 grain traders. The fact that seed, which used to be in the hands of billions of farmers, is in the hands of, at this point, one gene giant, but ultimately they're 5. Monsanto, Syngenta, Dow, Pioneer Hybrid. These are the companies. In the case of grain trading, it used to be Cargill, Continental, but Continental was eaten up by Cargill, and it's Conagra and ADM and Bunge. And the volumes in which they trade decides the price. If they want to bid low, they go low. The day they want to go high, they go high. Their profits in these last few weeks have increased 90%, while people die of hunger. But there is a second integration. So what you've done is integrate the economy of the poorest with the economy of the biggest and the economy of the rich. And obviously now it's going to drag up the prices. But there's a second integration which is dragging prices upwards. And that has to do with another transformation in the food system. Food is no more viewed as a fundamental right to nourishment and nutrition. That's the most basic need. You need it. Everyone needs it for survival. Food is now a commodity. And as a commodity, its only value is trade. And as a commodity, in the current economic framework of liberalized trade, the value of this commodity is not how much can you afford to buy in your economy, but how much returns do investors expect out of it. Your country has seen the subprime crisis in mortgages. The really hungry investors went into real estate. When mortgages started to fail, they needed something else to invest in. They've moved into food. Hedge funds have moved into food commodity trading in a very big way. Between hedge funds and investment banks, seeking nothing less than 25% return per year out of commodity trading, obviously it means we have to increase prices of food 50% a year just to keep them going, if their economy has to keep going. Because once you've linked up the food distribution with the speculative financial economy through futures trading and commodity trading, it goes somewhere else. There's another element of this, of food as a commodity, agriculture produce as a commodity. Commodities are totally substitutable. You know, when my friends from the slums cried about mustard oil disappearing, for them, it was not tradable. You know, mustard oil was mustard oil. It had a particular taste, a particular pungency, a particular flavor, a particular nutrition. can't be substituted by soya. But once it's a commodity, then soya can come into your kitchens. It was never meant to be used as either flour or oil. The smart East Asian countries that have used soya for centuries only used it in fermented form, because fermented, it neutralizes the anti-nutritive factors in soya. And now we're getting all these huge doses of unneutralized soya in our diet. It can be sold and imposed on countries like India. The soya lobby even talked of India being the El Dorado for soya sales. That's where they were going to make the millions. But it can go for cattle feed. And, India, I mentioned, we haven't overnight become meat eaters. A few Indians go to those crazy McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chickens. But it's a 0.0001%, And that's... And even those guys have had to become vegetarians. They have to do McAloo ki tikki. The McDonald burger has to become a tikkia, and they serve chutneys instead of ketchup. They want the Indian palate. Even in the case of China, which has always had, some Buddhists have been vegetarians in China, but the Chinese have eaten meat vigorously. But to eat meat does not mean to consume grain, because in most cultures, meat has been grass-fed. It's only in recent years with factory farming that grain has started to get diverted to the meat industry. And selling feed is another very big business of agribusiness. And I remember going into areas where the shrimp farms were doing a lot of destruction, and Cargill was selling the feed for the shrimp. And the conversion ratios are crazy. You need to put in 15 times more fish as feed to get 1/15th out as shrimp protein. Beef, similar. Factory feeding of animals with grain is a very, very inefficient use of photosynthesis on this planet. But now, since that famous speech of President Bush about Americans needing to get off their addiction to oil, he immediately created this biofuel law and created the biofuel subsidies. And I've always been fascinated with this. WTO came into being in 1995. Ministerial after ministerial has collapsed, beginning with Seattle, then in Cancun, nearly collapsed in Hong Kong, over the issue of agricultural subsidies. And the US government keeps saying, we can't touch it, we can't touch it, we can't touch it. But within a year, they can create a whole new subsidy structure for biofuels. So where it comes to decisions on behalf of the powerful, it's very effective, it's very quick. Where it comes to defending the family farmer, the rights of the poor to food, oh, we can't really do it, it's too difficult, we can't move. In this 1 year of this law, the destabilization created by biofuels is tremendous. But it's a destabilization that works with the speculation, because it's the same speculative agribusiness that is involved in biofuels. So it's not the literal arithmetic diversion of percentages of food to biofuels that's leading to a proportionate increase, but it's leading to a huge increase because there's another use for that commodity. Of course, the original idea of biofuels was it's going to be a solution to climate change, it's going to reduce emissions, and it's going to be an alternative to cheap oil, to expensive oil at the time when cheap oil is running out. It doesn't work that way. The biofuel economy is a net negative energy economy. It uses more fossil fuels to make the biofuels. Then you substitute. And David Ehrenfeld has done some tremendous studies. 1% substitution is eating up 20% corn. 7% substitution will eat up 100% of the corn. So 93% will have to be picked up from somewhere else, which is why the Amazon is being cut down, which is why the rainforests of Indonesia are being chopped down. And if you add the increased emissions from the burning of those rainforests, which are such an important regulator of global climate, you actually have a net increase in emissions of a very large scale. Even the United Nations has had to send out a warning signal. So once your corn and soya and canola have been turned into commodities, and the market is left to decide where these commodities will go, a cow in a factory farm will always have higher purchasing power than a poor person in the third world. And a car will always have higher purchasing power than a poor person in the third world. It is designed to create hunger. There is, therefore, an absolute imperative to use this deep crisis to do what we should have done anyway with our food and agriculture. Created a food peace rather than food wars. Created an agriculture that was based on peace with the planet, peace for the farmers, and peace for the eaters. We could not afford the toxics we have pumped into the environment. We should never have done it. We don't produce more food through more toxics. We just produce more toxics. I get tired saying this, you know. It doesn't create high-yielding food. It creates high-yielding poisons. We should never have wasted scarce water on intensive irrigation. And then that water gets polluted. We should never have ended up using more fossil fuels as an input into the system than we get out in terms of energy. Let me just share some figures with you. You know, a 450 gram of breakfast cereal provides only 1,000 kilocalories of food energy, but uses 7,000 kilocalories of energy for processing. One cow maintained in the industrial system requires 6 barrels of oil, which can be used to drive a car from New York to Los Angeles. We are literally in the industrial food system and the globalized distribution of industrially produced food. We are literally eating oil. We are eating oil in the content of the food, in the fertilizers that go into the food, in the packaging that goes into the food. Every bit is intensification of fossil fuel in the food, not an intensification of health, nutrition, taste, and quality. The imperative that this current emergency creates is going to be used by those who have created it to deepen their hold on the agriculture system. Already, agribusiness is working to towards governments declaring zero tariffs on imports, which will mean further destruction of domestic production, which will mean more scarcity and therefore a deeper crisis. They're also encouraging export bans. Interestingly, the famous basmati from my valley has been banned for exports. So now Rice Tech, which took a patent on basmati, is going to have a monopoly worldwide. So the export bans aren't going to help the production system, because the crisis is a crisis of production and sustainable production. It's a crisis of signals being given to producers, don't produce food. For third world producers, the signal is grow flowers, grow shrimp, grow vegetables, grow Brussels sprouts. I hear these Hindi programs and these farmers saying, see, what is Brussels sprout? Poor guy's never grown it. He's never going to eat it. But this nutritional apartheid was created that the third world shouldn't grow food. It should import grain from the Midwest of USA. And it should use its fertile lands and water to grow flowers and other commodities. 8 million hectares in India has gone out of food products, food crops, to growing flowers and fruits and vegetables for exports. Kenya, the entire Rift Valley, is only growing flowers and fruits and vegetables for exports. The combination of non-sustainable production and unfair distribution is being intensified. Another entry point that's being used, I hear a lot of people say, oh, now that there's a food crisis, we will need genetically engineered crops. Why? If they produce less, if they're killing our farmers, why do we need them? Ecological agriculture is the only lasting way through which we can produce food at low cost both to the environment, to the farmer, and to the consumer. We've done lots of research to show that biodiverse, small ecological farms can produce 2 to 10 times more food than an industrial farm. You just have to measure the full output in nutrition. You have to measure nutrition per acre, not the yield of a single commodity. Because once you measure a commodity, more of that commodity means more of that commodity, which means convert more biodiverse systems into monocultures. Convert the Amazon into a soya plantation. Convert all the small farms of the third world into growing monoculture commodities. But there is another reason why we must promote ecological sustainable agriculture for food peace. And that is related to the fact that only through this can we both mitigate climate change as well as adapt to it. Our research is showing that we have 200% more return of carbon in organic farms. Farms with organic matter in the soil are the only farms that can see themselves through a drought. There's a huge drought taking place in central India right now. It's only the farmers who work with us and do organic farming whose crops haven't failed. The farmers that depend on chemical agriculture, chemical fertilizers, and purchased seeds have had a total crop failure. Biodiversity and organic is our system of resilience to deal with these totally volatile times of climate change, but also with volatile markets. But volatile markets need two additional steps. First is to have reverence for food as food. Because as a commodity, A, it will keep degrading, and two, it will not be within the reach of most people. I think all people have a right to good food. And the only way to grow good food is with care. Not with toxics, not with fossil fuels, but we have to maximize care. That means localization. Doesn't mean you don't get your coffee and your bananas, but it does mean if you can grow vegetables locally, you don't steal the water of someone far away. It also means that if the U.S. could start providing for all its food needs as close to where the people are, this food war of desperately trying to grab the markets of other lands will stop. There is no surplus in this country. It's an illusion of surplus. Because if you put all your land under corn and soya, there will be lots of corn and soya, but you'll have to import everything else. And you are importing everything else. The point is, if 1 billion Indians and 1 billion Chinese stop producing food, which would be the consequence of this system, there isn't enough food in the Midwest to feed even the 5% elites of our country. This is what is at the roots of the riots right now, but the riots right now are just an early signal of how bad and ugly things could get. We can no more treat organic as a luxury. We can no more treat local as a luxury. It has become the real place where we have to create peace on this planet. You know, as long as the food economies were in women's hands, and they were, in peasant economies, food is in women's hands. Women are the seed keepers. They decide what seed they'll save. Women decide what they'll grow. There are two key principles women use. One is they will maximize nutrition for their family. And I've seen in households in rural India where the husband will say, let's do potato. You know, let's grow potato. And the wife's saying, no, we'll grow the food. Maybe one little patch we'll do potato. At no point have women reduced their mind to thinking from the outside, from the marketplace. They think from the inside. They have to look after their home. They have to look after their children. And that's why I really believe that we need to reclaim food security in women's hands. I know a lot of my feminist colleagues think food was a prison, motherhood is a prison, everything's a prison, except becoming a slave to Cargill and Monsanto. That's not a liberation. I run a course called the Grandmother's University. at our school, the Beach Vidyapeeth. And it's a very simple course. Let the wisdom of our grandmothers not die out. It's as precious as every species that we need to protect and is, in fact, our bridge to the future. The day we have lost our connection with our grandmother's heritage, humanity has lost its capacity to survive as a species. And to me, that's my basic philosophy of ecofeminism today. I'm not a grandmother yet, but I really have respect for the wisdom. I mean, tremendous, tremendous wisdom. What they can do with food, how they can use every bit of a plant, you know, things that you never learn. How they know from the taste of food what's wrong with it. Which brings me to your second question. I am now elected vice president of this international movement called Slow Food. And I've been interacting with the Slow Food movement for a number of years. They really liked what we did with mustard and decided to join hands. Also, when I fought the case against RiceTech, this company whose basmati you will be condemned to buy because you won't be able to get the real authentic stuff from us till we fight one more battle to get the ban removed. But the most important interaction with Slow Food was over the last 6 years, I've been chairing a commission on the future of food. And I know Southend Press has published these manifestos on the seed and the manifesto on the food, which this commission has brought out. Petrini is a member of this commission. And over these years, I kept saying, you know, you just work on pleasure and taste, you're going to be obsolete very soon. I used to keep telling him there's a food crisis coming with globalization. And you can't only address a small elite crowd that can afford it. The real place where the food issues have to be defined is in food production, peasant cultures. And Slow Food has taken that on. That is why now, for the first time, they're starting chapters in India. They had their first congress in Mexico, in Pueblo. And I know they're coming to California for the Slow Food Nation. I think it's in end of August or early September. One reason I work with the Slow Food is I really do believe we cannot afford to think that good food is a luxury only for the rich. I believe every child, no matter how poor they are, has a right to good food. I believe every culture, no matter how poor they are, has the capacity to produce good food. In fact, I'm now getting convinced with this food emergency that either we will all have good food or we will have no food at all. And that's why we must move to growing food sustainably, growing food with care, and creating the economies that allow good food to travel.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.